and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we're going to talk to a thriller writer, thriller slash mystery, I guess you'd call him. We'll ask him. His name is Henry Perez, and his new book is called Mourn the Living, and it is the second book in the Alex Chepa series, which didn't start out as a series, but we'll ask him about that too. Hello.
Hey, David. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. It just took me a... My reading habits have been so weird. It's been so hot here in Pennsylvania. I never know when I'm going to finish a book. And there's so many things that, your mind goes through. You know how that is.
Oh, yeah. My reading stack just seems to grow and grow. And there's so much good stuff to read. And, yes, you get the stuff when you can.
Now, this Mourn the Living, I find that title very interesting. I mean, it's one of those titles you think, well, I wonder what that means. And what... I got to read that just to find out what the title means. I mean, it's not every day you can see the word mourn in a thriller. In fact, I don't even know if I've ever seen the word mourn in a thriller before. Have you?
I'm not sure that I have. The title came, who knows where the title, I'm not giving anything away here. The title appears in the book, in the story itself at one point.
Right.
But the title and that story itself came to me pretty much complete, which was nice. I had the beginning, the middle, the end. I knew what the character motivations were for the most part. And for whatever the reason, within about 2 days of beginning the outlining process, I knew it was titled Mourn the Living.
Interesting. A lot of authors say they have trouble with their titles, that they agonize over what to call their books. Or they'll say the publisher knows what books will sell, knows what titles will sell. But it's a great title. I mean, it's one of those titles that you're like, wow, Mourn the Living. I shouldn't get Mourn the Dead, you know?
Well, I've been fortunate, and, knock on wood, because I'm only the two books plus the two books I'm working on now, I'm only four books into my career so far, and I haven't had a problem with titles. Killing Red, my first book, arrived in my mind as Killing Red, and I know I have a number of author friends who, as you say, struggle with a title, or will change the title several times during the process.
Well, how important do you think the title is to selling the book and being able to get the book out there? I mean, how important do you think that is?
It's like naming your child.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, your parents decided to name you David, and you've had that name with you your entire life. And my parents named me Henry. I've had that name, and that's part of our identity, and I think that's the same thing with a book. It's or a film for that matter, or a song title. I think it's huge.
Mm-hmm.
Some titles grab your eye, and as you say, you begin to wonder, well, what's that supposed to mean?
I actually have an advanced copy of your book. I don't have the actual cover, but I've seen it in the bookstores. I'm not even sure what it is on the cover of your book.
On the cover, that's an interesting question, because I've been very happy with both of my covers.
I'm looking at Killing Red here in front of me. I love the cover on Killing Red. It just.
And yet there isn't except for the blurb from James Rollins. There is no red on that cover.
Exactly.
Which was interesting when it arrived. I've been asked a lot about my covers and whether I'm happy with them and such. And of course, the first question you get is, did you get to pick your cover? And the answer is a resounding no.
Right.
You have a little bit of input, but ultimately the publisher makes that decision for the overwhelming majority of authors. And in the case of Killing Red, I've described it a little bit as being like when your first child is born.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my wife and I looking at pictures of ourselves as children, sort of speculated, what's she going to look like and so forth. And then the big day comes and your child is born and you see her for the first time and she looks nothing like what you speculated, but she's still cute.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it's sort of, oh, okay, this works. Hey, this is great. And that's how it was with Killing Red.
Right.
I love that cover. With Mourn the Living, I also got very lucky. It's a terrific cover.
Mm-hmm.
With it's a body, a prone body across the front of the book with four splash marks.
Well, see, when you look at the cover from afar, you don't realize what it is. It's only when you get up close and you pick out the book that you realize what it is on the cover, too.
Yeah, which is cool.
Yeah.
And there's some covers out there that are not great, let's just say. And I've gotten very lucky with my first two books.
Now, Mourn the Living, which is the one we're talking about now, is really, I mean, I was reading yesterday, I just couldn't put this thing down. I mean, it was like, you know, before you know it, you're just totally caught up in this story and Alex Chapman, you know, and his daughter, and it just, there's so much to this book. I mean, more than you first think there is. When you first start out the book, it seems a simple book, but it's far from a simple book.
Thank you. Well, it builds. It builds slowly.
Do you do that on purpose?
Absolutely. The two books are very different.
Well, and that's an interesting subject, too, because they didn't seem like they were the same characters at first. I had to, you know, think, wait a minute, are you sure it's the same character that from Killing Red?
I think the characters doesn't change very much, but the structure of the two books.
So why did you change the structure?
Well, Killing Red I wrote as a standalone. Mm-hmm. I had no intention of writing a series.
But didn't you think in the back of your mind that it might become a series if it was successful?
Oh, I was open to that, yeah. And the reaction to Killing Red was so positive. I was, the enthusiasm that toward Killing Red and toward that character, the Alex Chapa character, my protagonist, was such that really before Killing Red hit the stores, I had already decided to write the second book, and I had a second book I wanted to write anyhow. But I didn't approach Killing Red that way. And Killing Red is very lean, very fast. It's a tight timeline. Just 6 days until the villain is to be executed, and that's the amount of time Chapa has to find the woman who's missing.
And the thing is, when you're reading the book, it doesn't seem like 6 days. It's hard to, you know, unless you have the book broken, I don't know if it's broken down into days, is it?
It is, yes.
It is. Oh, okay, because it's been a while since I've read it. But it never seems like 6 days when you're reading the book. It always seems like it's longer for some reason. To me, I don't know.
Well, I've described it as the strangest 6 days in anyone's life.
Yeah. But Killing Red is so different that it's so unusual that once you get done it, you realize just how well it's written.
Thank you. And with more of the living, I wanted to... And I describe Killing Red as essentially one very taut thread that goes from beginning to end, and I don't deviate from that very much. It follows a very strong line from beginning to end, and I wanted to make it a roller coaster ride, mm-hmm. a book you could read in one sitting.
Now, what prompts you to determine that that's what you wanted to do? I mean, what why, you know what I'm saying? Why would you determine to do it that way? I think it's great, but why that way?
Because I'd love to read a book like that.
So you're writing a book that you would love to read?
Absolutely.
Is that what you do every time?
I don't think I could write it and enjoy the process otherwise. I read a lot, and I read a variety of writers.
Well, who is the best writer that you have come across that does that? That goes up and down like a road, like you talk about.
Well, I'll talk one book in particular. David Morrell, about I think 4 or 5 years ago, wrote a book titled Creepers.
I read that. Yes.
And Creepers, I believe, takes place on an 8-hour time span.
Mm-hmm.
I love Creepers. Another one, Joe Conrath, writing as Jack Kilborn.
Oh yes.
Wrote a book titled Afraid. Came out a couple years ago.
Afraid, yes.
Takes place over a very short amount of time. And in the case of Afraid, he does jump around in viewpoints. But with Creepers, we don't. And I love that type of book. And I wanted to, you know, I've always loved that type of book. The Ticking Time Bomb.
Yeah.
And that's what I set out to do with Killing Red. With More in the Living... it's interesting, you referred to me as a mystery and thriller author. I think More in the Living probably walks those two paths, as a mystery and a thriller.
Well, I mean, and people ask me this all the time. Even at the store, we're thinking of combining our thrillers and mystery section. And, I mean, they're so similar, it's just, it's ridiculous. I mean, how do you determine what's a mystery and what's a thriller?
Boy, now we've just gotten into one of the really popular mystery festival questions, haven't we?
Right. Well, the international thriller writers could probably give me an hour discussion about this, at least an hour, and
at
tell
least
me.
An hour, yes, depending who's on the panel.
But I mean, what determines? I mean, if there's a killing in it, I mean, Mary Higgins Clark has killings in her books, but we think of her more as mystery than thriller. But they certainly could be classified as thrillers.
Well, I think a thriller tends to have a limited time element. The protagonist has to resolve this thing, whatever that is, whatever the problem is, in a limited time, or something truly awful is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
With a mystery, it's there's usually a larger secret that needs to be revealed. An identity, obviously the identity of a killer being the standard. But there's a larger truth that needs to be revealed. Now, both genres are going to have elements of each. With Mourn the Living, I think Mourn the Living has more of a mystery to it than Killing Red does. They both have a mystery element, but I think that's more central to Mourn the Living.
Now, starting in Mourn the Living, how old is Alex Chappa? I'm trying to remember the age. And
42.
And he was how old in Killing Red?
He's only about 2 weeks younger.
In Mourn the Living, it's interesting that he's suddenly realizing he's getting in over his head. I mean, it's like a tidal wave. It's slowly taking over his life, and he doesn't realize what's really happening at first.
Right, and that's one of the things that that I enjoyed was the personal thread from Killing Red. Mourn the Living begins 5 days after Killing Red ends.
Mm-hmm.
And the personal thread carries over. The issues that he has. Alex Chappa, and where that character comes from, I have a fascination with people who are exceptional at their jobs, but can't function in their personal lives.
Yeah.
Can't accomplish things that, you know, whether it's having something resembling a good marriage or being a good parent. This is where they trip up. However, they are fantastic at this other thing that they do professionally. Alex Chappa is a great newspaper reporter.
Mm-hmm.
He was an awful husband. He's not good with his finances. He really can't do the everyday things that rest of us do.
He sure is good at confronting people and telling them how he really feels, though.
He's pretty good at that, yeah.
He's excellent at that. That's what makes...
and when he's... I believe it's in Killing Red. There's a moment in Killing Red where his personal life is blowing up on him. And he goes to... He does what he does, which is he goes into the office. He has no specific reason for going there, but it's his haven, and I think I described it as his drug of choice. You know, he doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, but this is what he does. He goes to work. He finds a story.
Was that you? Was that your drug of choice at one time?
No.
Never?
Actually, I'm... Alex Chappa and I are not alike. I've worked as a reporter.
But you did a lot of what he did.
Yeah, but I was never up on a window ledge or...
but I mean, generally, as a reporter, you did what he did.
To some extent, sure.
Right.
Sure. You may find this shocking, but the life of an average reporter is nowhere near as interesting as Alex Chappa's. I'm fascinated by people like him because I'm not like him.
Do you even have a young child like he does, Nikki?
I have two children, but I'm also happily married, and my personal life is quite good.
Well, his little girl in this book is so endearing. I mean, we can't even see what she looks like, I mean, except in our minds. But she's so wonderful. I mean, every scene she's in, the questions she asks are like, all I can think to myself is, this author must have a child that's asking questions like this.
Well, it's also an interesting contrast to Chappa, because as you say, Chappa is very good at not just confronting people, but understanding how to take control of a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And except where his child's involved. And where his child's involved, he's clueless. And part of his process throughout Mourn the Living is coming to understand the fact that that's where he's really in over his head.
But at the same time, he realizes that spending time with his daughter is the most important thing that he needs to do, and he does it in this book. He doesn't spend major hour after hour after hour, but he knows enough to spend some time with her. So he knows he's somewhat good at that level.
Yes, and when he's not spending time with her, when he is now going back to the job, he is well aware of the fact that he probably isn't where he should be.
It eats away at him. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
It definitely eats away at him. It's funny the way they portray people on television and in books a lot of times. They just go to their work. Their work is more important. And while they realize their family's important, but their work always seems to come first, even though they realize it's wrong. And there's such a draw with this society we live in that work as much as you can, make as much money as you can, so you can retire or whatever, you know, and be a workaholic. And that's almost accepted nowadays.
Well, And yes, it is. And for me, throughout this book, Alex Chapa had to come to terms with the decisions that he's made in the past and the ones he's still making. And he's divorced. His wife has remarried and moved to Boston. And he doesn't get to see his daughter very often. And that runs through Killing Red. And then it becomes a major factor in Mourn the Living. And I knew that by the end of Mourn the Living, he was going to have to really accept the idea that a lot of the choices that he made in the past and a lot of the ones he continues making are at the root of most of his problems. Of course, that also means accepting the idea that thing that he loves to do most, which is get himself into really difficult stories that he's covering, is something that he may have to figure out how to balance with everything else.
And you just wonder at the end what it's going to cost him. And of course, I've read the whole book, so I know, but I can't give anything away. But, you know, he's realizing more and more that if I keep this up, I'm going to lose what I have. That the things that I find precious are not going to be there after I'm done.
Exactly. And there's a moment in Mourn the Living that I really enjoyed writing, and that's it's Chapa's moment of weakness, if you will. He stops before going into something and asks himself, "What am I doing here?"
Right.
And that's a question I'm pretty certain he has never asked himself before in a work situation.
Now, did you ask yourself that a lot when you were reporting?
No, I tend to stay out of dark alleys. I tend to. Well, you know what? Let me take that back. Yes, there were a couple of times.
There's got to be something. I mean,
yes, because you do find yourself in very weird situations that you suddenly realize could turn ugly.
I mean, you write,
but could.
But you write a piece. Say you write a piece on a politician, and it's very derogatory. I mean, could something happen as a result of that? Could somebody come after you? Could you be accosted when you leave the building, or somebody accost you with a gun or something? And politics is such an unusual subject for people. People feel so strongly about it. I mean, they just hate these politicians that don't agree with what they agree with. You know, and that's so much a part of of people's lives nowadays. I mean, you have a political discussions. I mean, you can get pretty heated pretty quickly.
They do, and you know, Mourn the Living sort of brushes up against politics a little bit. Mm-hmm. But to me, the real threat, and this is true in the real world as well as on the page, comes from dangerous situations, desperate people that you mingle with, and there's a scene in Mourn the Living where Chapa goes to investigate an area, and that sort of a passageway, an alley,
right,
where a body had been found, and it's in broad daylight, but it's not a particularly it's a troubled area, across from a liquor store, and there's a bit of a threat there. Well, you find yourself in those situations. Everyone at one point or another finds themselves in that kind of a situation.
So you're in a really bad neighborhood. Do you ever drive and get lost and find yourself in a really horrible neighborhood?
Oh, we all have.
And you think, oh, am I going to live through this? And
we
all you
have.
Can think of
and,
is, how did I get to this point, you know?
And when it's your job to go into that area, for whatever the reason, you always balance the need to get that done with the situation. And part of the trick is you don't put the danger out of your mind necessarily, but you sort of gird your loins and toughen up and go into it, and Chapa does that very well. He is always aware of his surroundings, though.
Right.
He's very much aware of the fact that what he's doing here could be lethal if he's not too careful.
Now, both of your books have been in paperback so far. Who is the one that decides what is going to be a paperback original? I guess these are called paperback originals, right?
Right.
And what's going to be a hardcover? How do they decide what is the best format for books?
Well, that's the publisher. And Kensington is primarily a paperback publisher.
Now, you don't get, is it still true that you don't get as reviewed as much as when you're in paperback? I know I saw a real nice review in on bookreporter.com of your book.
Well, I've been fortunate. Publishers Weekly reviewed.
Oh, they did?
Mourn the Living. And
wow.
Typically, from what I understand, that is the case. But I've been fortunate with reviews.
That's great.
Thank you. Yeah, I've... But... I tell you what, when Killing the Red came out in paperback, that was June of 2009. The economy was doing so poorly that I'm glad it came out in paperback, because for a new author today to try and sell a $25 hardback, I can't imagine. I can't imagine how big of a challenge that would be, but it has to be a challenge.
It is, and believe me, I have trouble selling hardcovers. It depends on how well I like the book. Too, a lot of it is dependent on how good the book is. Sometimes I'll tell a customer, I'll say, "Well, it's worth the money," or if I enjoyed it, but it wasn't the best thing I've ever read. It's kind of harder to talk the customer into it, because they see right through that.
It's three paperbacks. It's that simple. You can get three paperbacks, or it's just a lot harder, particularly when the readers have no idea who this guy is.
Right, and then I guess the paperbacks stay on the shelves longer too, because they're not as eager to return the paperbacks as they are the hardcovers. If the hardcover doesn't sell, it gets pushed aside for something else. There's so many hardcovers coming out nowadays.
I've been very happy with the fact that The Killing Red and Mourn the Living are both paperback originals, because I know for me personally, when I've done appearances and such, people are more willing to take a chance on you,
right?
And then hope to discover a new author whom they'll enjoy when they don't have to worry about paying $25 for a hardback. It's just a tough sell right now in this market, I think.
Yeah, it is. We all know how tough. I mean, the indie bookstores are just having such a hard time competing, and it's understandable. But you go into the chains, and sometimes they only advertise the top authors. I mean, whereas authors that are good like you don't even get to the front of the store a lot of the times.
Thank you again. Well, the chains and the indies have both been very, very kind to me so far. So I've got no complaints on that front. I love the indies just because of the personal touch.
Right.
When I go through now and I've cast a broader net this time in terms of the area that I've covered after Mourn the Living came out as opposed to Killing Red. But when I go back to indie stores that I visited during the tour for Killing Red, I'm talking to the same people again. That's not always the case, of course, with the big box stores. And it's just nice. It's nice to build that relationship. And even as the economy shifts and certainly the book market shifts, and now the advent of e-readers, I actually think that the indie bookstores are in a pretty good position going forward, because they are able to serve a community.
Absolutely,
directly.
Yeah. You got people that depend on you. They come in, they want to know what's good, and they're not going to get that from the box stores a lot of the time. The big stores, the big chains.
Absolutely.
I mean, and nothing against the people that work there, but they're not the most book trained kind of people. A lot of them are, coming to the job because it's a job, and not necessarily because they read a lot. It all depends. I've seen some that do and some that don't. But I mean, you go in. If I said your name in Barnes and Noble, local here, they may or may not know who you are. You are rather new,
right?
But I mean, if you talk to a big book reader, they probably would know who you were. But it's a game, because you just don't know. The indies remember. I mean, I remember your books, and I'll remember your books for a long time because they're good. But it's and I'll sell anything that is good. I don't discriminate with authors. If it's a good book, I'll sell it. And that's how I feel.
And from the author's standpoint, obviously, it's the best thing is to have a presence in as many places as possible. And as I said, Barnes & Noble and Borders have been terrific to me.
All right.
And have stocked both books, and I've had advantages or breaks like that I realize most new authors don't get.
Mm-hmm.
I've been very fortunate.
Now, was Mourn the Living harder to write than Killing Red, or are certain books harder to write? You say you're working on three and four now. Which has been the hardest?
Well, I'm working. Well, okay.
Maybe that was two questions.
I think I may have turned them into two questions. I think it was one question. They were different. I don't know how. I've been asked that question before, and I still don't have a straight answer for it, because they were just simply different to write. Killing Red.
And And it's nice to see a series change a little bit. I mean, there's a change. I mean, you read, as much as I love Sue Grafton, and I do love Sue Grafton a lot, her books are pretty much the same every time around. They're more intense, or they're better written. Some of them are, in my mind, are better written than others. But you pretty much have Kinsey, and she's going to be basically the same way every book.
Now, see, I marvel at people who can do that, through an entire series.
But I want to. But at the same time, you take an author like Cody McFadden, where every book his characters are changing, and they're having horrible things happen to them. But they're changing. Their lives are changing with every book.
I guess the answer is I honestly don't know whether I know how to write a traditional series. I know how to write stories about this character, but. Structurally, I think it's clear Killing Red is somewhat different from Mourn the Living. Same character.
But the publisher wants more of Alex Chapa, I assume.
That would be, typically, it's yes. It is a very strict, after Killing Red, it was a sense of, this is what an Alex Chapa novel is like. But my editor at Kensington, my publisher, really gave me a lot of leeway with Mourn the Living. Mourn the Living was a joy to write, frankly. I knew where the story was going. I knew I had, I think, three or four really big sequences in Mourn the Living, and those are flat out fun.
And the plane being one of them, I'm sure. The plane is a fantastic scene.
That's sort of the center point.
Did you have to learn about flying planes?
Yes,
you'd have to, or it would just sound terrible if you didn't.
Well, a friend of mine is an airline captain.
Oh, there you go.
And so I had written a scene out, and I told him, okay, this is what I need to have happen. And he and I, without giving away too much, of course, here, but he and I went through, over the course of several hours, all the possibilities, all the different situations, all the issues that could arise. But I had that scene, before I wrote the first sentence of Mourn the Living, I already had that scene. And... Mourn the Living, I was really excited about writing, and I enjoyed the process from beginning to end. I enjoyed Killing Red as well, but I knew the character of Chapa better at that point.
And the thing with Alex Chapa is, I don't always like Alex Chapa. There are chapters that I read of his, and I get mad at him.
I don't always like Alex Chapa.
And there are times I think, what a selfish brat. But that means the character is affecting me, that I'm caring about the character. I want the character to be a certain way, but I know in the back of my mind he's not going to be that way. And I'm actually looking forward to some scenes in future books, and I assume they're coming, between him and his ex-wife.
Well, I'm working on the third book. And
but I want to see a really intense scene between the two of them. That's what I want. That's what I'm hoping for. A knock them out, drag them out, scream at each other kind of scene. That's what I'm hoping for.
That's what you're hoping for.
Yes, indeed. Well, I think it's almost to the point where it's necessary. I mean, if she doesn't know what's happened in Mourn the Living, I don't know how much she knows in book three of what he's put the little girl through.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know where, maybe she never finds out. I don't know. We have to wait for book three for that
well,
one. But.
Well, and that's an ethical and parenting dilemma for Chapa anyway.
Yeah.
Because,
I mean, any parent in her position would be horrified by some of the things he takes her to.
Absolutely, and
even if it is inadvertently.
There are times that I'm not too fond of Chapa, but he's going to get it right in the end.
But do you have to love a character 100% in order to write them?
No. Oh, I wouldn't.
I mean, did Thomas Harris like Hannibal Lecter? How could he?
Now, see, I kind of, the characters I love 100% are usually minor characters. There's a character in Mourn the Living named Ladrone.
Right.
I love Ladrone. That's a character I love 100%.
So do you bring him back?
I've got to bring him back. It's just the reaction I've gotten to that character in the months since this book has been out has been such that I would have brought him back anyway. I may write a short story about Ladrone.
And some characters just come right out of the pages. I was telling you about Starvation Lake. There's a character, one of the reporters at the where he works, that is just, she's just tremendous. I mean, she's too good of a character to let go. And that's what happens. And I think the readers sometimes know it before the writer does.
Oh, quite often. Because sometimes the character's a device. In Killing Red, there's a... a bar owner named Munson.
Mm.
At a place called a bar down in Joliet, Illinois, just a down by the river, not a particularly nice place. And Munson's a bit of a character, obviously. But I had a lot of people come to me and say, "Boy, we love this Munson character." And he has one chapter.
Right.
And yet, so
we bring him back too, then.
Well, actually, he's mentioned in passing in Mourn the Living, but he will be coming back at some point. Yes.
And people just fall in love with characters. It's just like a TV show. They like some characters. I mean, you look at Happy Days, and Fonzie was supposed to be an aside character. He wasn't supposed to be a big character. He took over the whole show.
Exactly.
And that's what happens sometimes. I mean, people love certain Rizzoli and Isles. You know, now they're huge. People just love them.
Well, and the beauty about minor characters is that they don't have a lot of weight to lift.
And people seem to be their heroes or people that, I mean, Rizzoli and Isles, neither of them have a life. They're all job and no life, and to me it does something to the character. The character becomes very hard edged, very cynical about things, you know. And I think you get that way at some point when you're not involved with somebody, when you don't quote have a life, what people consider a life. Am I making any sense at all?
Well, yes, it's a little like that person, that person who you only see every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you only see it in an ideal setting, and you think, well, that's the coolest person in the world. That's an interesting person. Well, you see a little more. You see a few of the maybe the darker stuff, and you get that with protagonists, with a good protagonist. But with a minor character, you're going to get the most interesting moment in that minor character's life during that week or that month or whatever. In the case of Ladrone, one of the things I like about that character is that he has a couple of things. He has a certain amount of nobility, despite the fact that he's a career thief, and also that he really has his priorities in order in a way that Chapa does not, which, again, is hard to imagine about a career criminal. But it's true. It's true, and those characters are a lot of fun to write. And
just like Hannibal Lecter, he had everything in order too. He knew exactly what he was going to do and who he was going to do it to.
Again, you know, can't manage his personal life very well. But however,
no, absolutely. But I mean, and the part, the fact you can't imagine why Clarice would even like this guy.
Well, there is a fascination there.
Absolutely fascinating. I mean, there is. But is fascination the same thing as love? I mean, you could be fascinated with somebody and not be in love with them.
No, I don't believe it is.
And yet, well, anyway, we're going to talk about Thomas Harris the rest of the way if we don't watch it. But I mean, Alex Chapa has somebody he loves. I mean, he loves Aaron. But, you know, there's times that in the book where we're not sure that he really does love Aaron.
He does love Aaron. He just, again, it comes back.
You're going to have to convince me in book three, because I don't think I'm totally convinced.
Well, things get interesting with him and Aaron in book three. I'll just leave it at that. But he does love Aaron. But the fact is, it goes back to his need to balance different elements in his life. And he struggles with this.
Well, thank God he's got somebody who will take care of his child while he's doing all the running around, too. So.
Well, yes, absolutely. And
they call it a built-in babysitter, don't they?
Aaron is also capable of calling Chapa out in a way that no one else in his life does.
She's very patient, and sometimes, and in book three, I'm sure she won't be as patient. I'm sure they're gonna have it out at some point. But she's very patient in Mourn the Living, more patient than I expected her to be.
To a point, she is. It does have a limit. To a point, she is.
Right. Well, I think she's
not giving anything away. I mean, to a point.
Yeah, she knows that he's getting it over his head, but she doesn't. I don't have to explain it. She doesn't know how bad it is, I don't think, she at first.
And well, in the third book, there...
Isn't it great we can talk about books like this? Especially ones that you've written, and you know what's going to happen next, and I don't.
In the third book, there is going to be, without giving too much away, there is going to be something of a showdown. And...
Well, you're not going to tell us who it's between.
No, I'm not. No, but it's...
Have you been talking to Jeffrey Deaver?
Well, yeah, in a sense, you don't want to get too far ahead of yourself, and that's really as much as anything. And you almost feel, if you talk too much about the book you're writing, I think you feel as though now you're committed to writing it that way.
Right.
And until you type the end.
Well, you probably already know the end of book three. You seem to be very aware of the endings in every book you. But the question is why you're working on book three and book four.
Book three is a chop. Will be the third chop of novel, and then I'm also. I don't think I'm in book three and four because the order is kind of irrelevant. But I'm also working on a standalone, which I.
Oh, I thought you were working on two more hours choppas. Oh.
No, but I do know. I do have the fourth hour chop in mind. But no, I'm working on a choppa and on a standalone at the same time.
Well, how does the standalone come into your mind? It just sort of comes into your mind. I mean, you wake up one morning and say, "Oh, I've got a standalone idea. I want to do that." Or how does that work?
This one is, and now you're really gonna hit a brick wall trying to get information from me. But this one's.
I think I've already resigned myself. In fact, I'm not gonna get much.
This is a story that I've wanted to tell for about 3 or 4 years now, and
I hear authors say that all the time, but I'm not sure I exactly know what it's just something that's been nagging at you.
Well, at least in my case, a lot of ideas come in like on a weekly basis, really. And
but how do you know which ones are can be made into a book, can be written, and which ones are just little ideas that aren't going to go anywhere?
Well, little ideas may end up being in the book somewhere. In some book somewhere. But every once in a while, you get an idea that lingers. And if it's still nagging me a week, 2 weeks later.
So it's been nagging you for 4 years.
It's been nagging me. Well, I knew this was going to be a book I would write.
Well, just please tell me that Kensington's going to let you publish it.
Well, we'll see. I leave up to my agent, and we go wherever we go, whatever happens. But I'm pretty confident about this standalone idea. I'm very happy with the way that book is coming.
Is this definitely a standalone, or could it be a series if it's successful enough?
Well, it's not. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but it's got a compelling protagonist. Who will likely survive? Let's leave it at that.
You're a very likable guy for some reason.
Oh, thank you.
And I don't know why I just said that, but you're very easy to talk to. You're very easygoing, which I find a lot in authors. But you know, you listen well too, which is amazing to me. I get authors who just talk, and while I like that, I get kind of overwhelmed with their talking too. You know, but you listen and you're short with your answers sometimes, which is nice because then I can ask more questions.
Well, that's cool. I have to talk less. That's also cool.
It's very cool for me because, meanwhile, I'm trying to think of this really great question I can ask you to really flummox you, you know, and which I tend to like to do. Like I'll ask an author, "Do you think you're a great writer?" And they'll stop and they'll think, "Well, how do I answer this one?"
Ooh, that's a tough question.
It's a time bomb ready to explode, you know. But I mean, should you feel like you're a great writer? I mean, does that build your confidence?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, think about that for a minute. I think I'm a pretty darn good storyteller. I hope I am.
But, I mean, you look at all the reporters that become writers. I mean, there seems to be a very easy conversion from reporter to writer. But you were saying, go ahead, you can finish what you were saying, though.
It's a different kind of, there's no question in my experience writing for newspapers has played a huge role in my writing. That's obvious. That's a given.
But not every newspaper writer can write a book, though.
Well, that gets into the storytelling element. That's a different thing altogether, I think.
But reporters must have a huge imagination. I mean, look at Michael Connelly. My gosh, the man is just phenomenal. And he started out as a reporter, too.
In his case, sure. But I think Michael Connelly would probably have been a great writer, even if he'd never been a reporter.
Now, that's an interesting observation. You may very well be right. But don't you think being a reporter helped him out somewhat, too?
It does. And when I read Connolly, I do sometimes see the reporter's mind on the page in terms of how the details are laid out.
But how do you grow as how do you, now speaking just from you, how do you grow as a writer of each book you write? I mean, do you think you're a better writer because of More Than the Living? Do you think that's a better book than Killing Red, or do you think they're equally as great?
Oh, see, now that's a loaded question.
Well, we want to get into your mind. We want to know what you think.
Well, if someone
know.
A better parent with their second child than their first, I just a different parent with a different child.
Well, it can be if they've learned something
they
from the first child.
I think I'm probably better at getting that thing that I want to get out of a moment or a character or a chapter. I think I learned that. I like to think I'm a better writer now than I was before I started writing Killing Red. I think you'd have to be. That's just part of the growth. Wouldn't you want to be? Actually?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
So I think that's just part of the human process.
Well, that means the third book's going to be really great. Now I can hardly wait to read it.
Oh, great! No pressure. No. You better do even better.
Isn't it good to have pressure though? At some point.
Well, it's great to have pressure. And
do you do a lot of research for these books? I mean, how much time do you spend researching?
I do research as necessary. In the case of, again, not to get too far down this line, but of my standalone, because of the nature of the book, I've had to do extra research beforehand. However, typically, what I want to do is get the facts right. I'm not one of these writers who is going to write page after page after page to show you how much I've learned during the process of doing my research. My goal is to tell you a story and mm-hmm. to keep the pages turning. And to get you angry about the fact that it's 2:30 in the morning and you're still
well, that's exactly the way More in the Living reads. And you read that book, and I defy anybody out there to start this book and not finish it. It's very difficult because you get to the point where you have to know what's going to happen next and what is going on in this book.
And that's my goal. That's my goal. That's what I want to do to my reader. I want to create a book that they can't, the old cliche, you can't put down.
And I want to tell people out there, just when you start reading More in the Living, don't give up on it right away, because it is a little slow in the beginning, but it takes off very quickly after that.
But there's vital information at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
That's my approach as a writer to do that. Now, I want to make sure you mentioned a particular scene in More in the Living. You've got to get the details right. You have to get the details right. Now, I learned a lot more about all the different subjects that I researched while writing More in the Living and Killing Red than you will ever see on the page.
And yet, when you're reading that scene, the reader should feel this, is he going to survive this? What is going to happen to this guy? You have to have that. It's like in an action movie when the hero's getting into all this trouble and there's suddenly all these guns aimed on him. You know he can be killed, you know, and you know he's not going to be because he's the hero of the movie. But you still have to have that sense that person could die at any moment.
Well, it has to ring true also.
So how do you balance that? How do you do that? I mean, that's quite a talent to be able to do that.
You turn details into a problem is what you do, particularly in an action scene such as that. Let's get away from an airplane. Let's say you're in a car. All right. Well, if you have to drive a car through a particularly dangerous area, what are all the things that mechanically could go wrong, or it might become a physical challenge for the protagonist? Every one of those things has to be turned into a problem. Has to be turned into another reason. So what might start out as an obstacle? Oh, geez, I might not be able to do this because of that. Your job becomes to turn that into not a problem for you as a writer, but a hazard for the protagonist.
So you have to know, do you ever get into a scene, write a scene, and then suddenly realize you can't get out of it? Has that ever happened to you? I mean, Lisa Scottolini tells a story about that, about having got this character and stuck in this building and she couldn't get her out.
I don't. That hasn't happened to me because the moment that I have a setting, come up with a setting that is of that nature, before I ever sit down to start writing it, I need to work it through in my head. And there's always a way out of it. There's always some way out of it. And so, and as a result of my approach to that, I usually know the resolution of that sequence before I even start writing it. Sometimes I work backwards also.
So, book three and book four, without giving anything away, and I don't want you to, believe me, you know from beginning to end what's going to happen in book three and then that standalone.
Yes.
I keep calling it book four because but the standalone. You know exactly what's going to happen from beginning to end. Every scene?
No, not every scene. I think of them in terms of mile markers along the way. For example, with
but you know where it's going. It's like those puzzles where they start with one word and you have to finish with the other word. You know what, how to get from what, you know the beginning word and the end word, but you don't know what's going to happen in between necessarily.
I know the beginning, I know the end, and I usually know several key points along the way. And I compare this to, let's say, driving from where you live in Pennsylvania to California. You know where you're going to start. You're going to end up in L.A. You know along the way you're going to see the Grand Canyon. Maybe you'll see a couple of other sites. You know that. Now, if I asked you, unless you really hyper-plan your trip and you're smart about it, if I asked you, where are you going to stay on day six? You might say, well, somewhere between Amarillo, Texas, and the Grand Canyon. But you don't know where. You don't know where you're going to eat along the way yet. And so I see it, to me, it's like a journey of that sort.
And what do you do about the characters, though? When do the characters appear in your mind? I mean, you know all the regular characters, but the characters that aren't in every book, how do you envision them in your mind as you're writing, or are they pretty clear to you before you start writing?
It varies. In the case of some of the minor characters, I know who they are before I begin the book. They're just there. They're just there as part of the setting. They're there, and I know why they're there. Other times, I will write myself into a scene or into a location and then begin to start thinking in terms of, well, who would populate this place? What type of individual would end up here?
And what's great about Ox Chapa is he doesn't necessarily care whether he keeps his job or not at this point. And more in the living. He really, you know, if he loses his job, it's not going to be a catastrophe to him. So that plays into the book, too.
And yet he has to still do his job. He's compelled to do his job. It's a tension that exists within Chapa. You're right. He's gotten so fed up with the system that he really can go either way at this point, whatever. However, Alex Chapa internally has to do his job for himself, for everything that he's worked toward. So there is that tension. He doesn't need the acknowledgement from the establishment, if you will. But he does need, on a personal level, to know that he's done his job.
Do you have is there a limit to how many books are going to be in this Alex Chapa series, or could there be 10?
David, I plan to write one. There could be four. There could be six.
You don't even know yourself.
No, I know there's a three, and I've got a four that I'm really getting excited about, but I can't allow myself to, because the next book is always sexier than the one that you're on page 240 of. But not always, but it can be. And so I know four is out there. But beyond that, I don't know. I said, I don't know that I know how to write a traditional series. I'm not sure that I do.
Well, you've already wrote two, so you're in the series whether you like it or not, you know?
Pretty much.
You're stuck. You're like in, but I don't consider it stuck because you write well, so I know you can do it. I don't ever doubt you can do it.
I keep calling More in the Living a follow-up, and then people like you keep calling it a series, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to lose that one.
Oh, I see.
No, it is.
You really don't think of it as a series. I wasn't getting that until you just said that.
I don't. Well, I'm of course you carry over. You have to carry over the things you already started, but things you already began. But
you're almost offended by the fact that I think of it as a series. That's what it sounds like.
I'm actually flattered by it because, as I said before.
Well, Alex Chapa is definitely interesting. We definitely want to see more. I don't think you could end the story if after More in the Living, even if you wanted to. People would want to know. You'd get letters saying, you know, more, more, more.
I've already gotten those letters, and I am thankful beyond words for those letters. But at the same time,
it does put pressure on you to write a great book. I mean, are you fearful sometimes that your book won't be good and people will stop reading it, stop reading your books?
There are moments when you wonder if this is working, but typically that's because you're writing something that needs to be revised.
I mean, you never want to write a book in a series to make, to me, I think to myself, when you read a book, you know whether it was forced or whether it's a good story. To me, you can always tell that. I never want to feel that an author's writing a book just to make more money, just to keep the series going, you know, just to keep the name going. I think that's unfair to the readers.
Yes. And
I can think of one in particular that I'm thinking of that is probably going on way too long, but it's so popular that it's never going to stop. And at that point, you just have to say, I mean, I'll still read the series, but I feel like I'm being cheated.
Well, through the third book and certainly into a fourth, I'm enjoying Alex Chapa's story.
I'm not saying you would ever get to that point. Yours has not.
I can't imagine. If I ever got to that point, I wouldn't write Alex Chapa. As I said, books one and two are somewhat different from one another. Book three, I'm sure, will go in a slightly different direction as well. I can tell you there's a significant change of setting for book three.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you the setup for book three of Chapa.
Ah, cool.
Well, there's a point in Mourn the Living where Joseph Andrews, Chapa's close friend, FBI agent,
right,
tells him that he really needs to get away. She tells Chapa, Andrews is a partial owner of a nice house down in the Keys in a secluded area of the Florida Keys,
right. Mm-hmm.
And tells him, you just need to get away, Alex. You know, get away from all this. Relax.
So this is his getaway book?
Alex Chapa's going to try to relax.
Ah.
In the Florida Keys.
But it's not going to be like Jessica Fletcher kind of relax.
No. He's incapable. He views this as the wording he uses is, I'm trying to achieve some relaxation. He doesn't know how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he's walking right into a very bad situation. And then we'll just have to go from there, won't we? So I suspect book three will be somewhat different from book two.
Do you already have a title for that and the standalone?
I do have both titled, yes.
And you can't tell us either one?
I'm not at liberty to reveal either at the moment.
Are they as interesting as the first two? I mean, to me, you have to continue that interesting title series.
I hope so.
I mean, you couldn't have a book called The Murder or something. I mean, if you did that, I think I'd have to call you and yell at you. I mean, that's crazy. You have to think of some interesting titles like Killing Red and More Than the Living. Those are very interesting titles to me.
Again, no pressure. There's
Yeah, right. Do you feel pressure now that I said that?
You know, I'm very happy with both titles. But, you know, there are people who do the one-word title. And Jeff Abbott, whose books I love.
Yeah, I think it takes away from a book. It's too, I don't know. It depends on how the writer writes, but I don't know.
When it's done properly, and I think Jeff does, I like the one-word title sometimes. I haven't come up with that one. If I come up with one of those one words, those single words, they've been taken. Somebody's already done this.
But you know what? I mean, you look at Harlan. I love Harlan's writing, don't get me wrong. I've loved everything he's written so far. With the exception of one book, which I won't mention, and if he's listening, I'm embarrassed. But he doesn't pick the greatest titles in the world. To me, I mean, they're not. Some of them are. I mean, Trust No One. It's you know, it resonates, but it's kind of sappy at the same time.
But see, I kind of like Trust No One.
Do you?
Yeah, I like that as a title.
I figured you would say that. I really examine my mind the titles sometimes. I mean, sometimes you just get the greatest titles. I mean. Town of Friendship is a new one. Faithful Place. It's an interesting title. It conjures up this. I wonder what this book's about. And she's a terrific writer. I mean, she's absolutely terrific. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I mean, come on, that's a great title. I mean, and a great series. I mean, they're just terrific titles. But I think, and then you know, other writers use the same title. So I don't know. To me, it has to be a mysterious title. Trust No One is good, but. After reading the book, it isn't the best title I would have thought for that book.
I've always liked Harlan's titles, actually, going back to when his was paperback originals, his first books. No, I have the same reaction as you. Some titles just grab us.
Yeah.
And I don't think there isn't a science to it. It's hard. Sometimes there are titles that you see and you think somebody tried to come up with a clever title.
But you come up with your titles even before you had the book written. I mean, book three and then the standalone, you had those titles before you started writing?
They come with the story.
Can you give us any initials or anything? That wouldn't be giving it away. Would you be violating your contract?
They come with the story for whatever the reason. Note how I'm ignoring your question. They how skillfully I'm not answering that.
Now I'm going to get all these emails saying, why did he ignore your question? Why didn't he get it to answer the question? Keep him on the ropes, you know? Do like a Barbara Walters kind of thing, you know?
They just, and again, I've had other author friends explain to me when they ask me, you know, how'd you come up with the title? And I tell them it was just there. They explain to me how much they hate me at that moment.
Really?
Because they've struggled to come up with titles. And again, I may very well come up with a title at some point that a publisher or an editor says no.
Now, your editors have already said okay to those two titles.
I've had no problems with titles at all.
Again, no, I mean,
I've been very fortunate.
The titles for 3 and the standalone, your editors already said okay, they're okay titles?
There won't be any kind of a problem. Yeah, it's pretty much.
Boy, I'm dying to know what these titles are. Maybe you could email me and tell.
Keep it on the down low.
But it is
something that, and again, I've been very fortunate in this regard. But it is something that, with.
I just think, in my mind, and I could be very wrong, but in my mind, certain titles resonate with me more than others. And More Than the Living is, to me, a much better title than Trust No One. But don't tell Harlan I say that. Said that, though.
That'll be just between you and me.
Right. I mean, and, you know, Sue Grafton has it easy. All she has to think of is one word. V is for what? You know, what is it going to be?
I do think that the Stephanie Plum series, though, has gotten awfully creative with the numbers.
It's interesting to see what she's going to pick. I mean, you think, I think they're up to, 16 or 17? I think 17 is the next one, but what are they going
to... 17 now, yeah.
And 7-Elevens are big in her series, so maybe she'll do something with the 7-Eleven. Or 7-Eleven at 17 or something. I don't know what she'd do, but...
After the first couple, which were pretty much written for her, title-wise, the series has gotten very, very creative. I've been pretty lucky with my titles, and I'm just wondering, what's the big deal?
Just don't go with a sappy title, all right? Please don't do that.
I won't. I'll try to avoid a sappy title at all costs. Yes.
I mean, there are sappy titles out there. I mean, we all know it. I mean, you see a title, oh, that's not very good. And sometimes, but you know what? Sometimes you're surprised. You read the book, and the book is actually better than the title.
Well, one of my favorite series titles, you know, clever as can be, is Joe Conrath's Jack Daniel's series, where they're all named after drinks.
Now that is clever. That's definitely clever.
That's very clever.
And the only author in history that has a chapter that's 2 words, you know, or 3 words, whatever it is, I can't remember how many it is, but just the funniest thing, funny and gross and totally gross at the same time. I mean, how many chapters do you see like that?
Yeah, Joe is a terrific writer. He and I wrote a novella together.
But for some reason, I cannot get a hold of that man. I don't know what it is. I wrote to him to try to get to you, and never heard back from him.
Well, you know, he's a diva.
I don't think he likes me anymore.
Well, there's that. He's a diva now.
Is he really?
No.
I thought you were serious or everything.
No, he and I wrote Floaters together, which a couple of years, a year, and we're going to write a follow-up to that in September this month. Floaters combined Alex Chapa and Jack Daniels.
Oh, that should be fun. And where will that be published?
Floaters is a Kindle ebook.
Oh, okay.
That we published it in, when was that? I want to say May of 2000 and last year, May of last year. And it's got a lot of mail about it. It's done quite well for us. A lot of fun to write with Joe.
Well, you are just a lot of fun, Henry. Now I know why J.A. Conrath says so many wonderful things about you.
Well, I pay him well, and I buy him lots of alcohol.
That always helps. That always helps. It's funny, I looked at your picture, and I thought, I wonder how much fun he'll be to talk to, because you never know. Even looking at a picture, you never have any idea whether they're going to be fun or not.
Well, I've determined that I want to have a different author picture with each book.
Right.
And I think there's a part of me that wants to make them increasingly sillier.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, next one, maybe I'm up on a horse dressed like a cowboy and just...
Now, that would be fun to see.
Headed toward the ultimate, which is, of course, the astronaut.
But you have to look grim. They always want you to look grim.
You have to look grim. You can't smile. It's as though I write mysteries, therefore I can't possibly be happy.
You could be on the same bridge that Harlan's on in his books. He's on a bridge in some of his, so that could be the same bridge.
Well, the bridge is a must. At some point, you got to do the bridge. And I just saw, I think it was with the amateurs, where Marcus Sakey is in an alley, and I thought, well, I haven't been in an alley yet.
That's a cool idea.
I'm going to have to go stand in an alley somewhere.
Well, this has been an absolute delight. I don't even want to end the interview. It's been so wonderful. You're such a great guy. And War in the Living, which is out from Kensington, I should mention that, Kensington paperback for $6.99, which is really cheap.
Or available, so I know, I don't want to...
No, or the Kindle. You can say the Kindle.
Where it hit number one.
Did it really?
It became...
I think you told me that. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
2 weeks ago, it was the number one best-selling, ahead of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and everything else.
But anyway, we have to sign off. I hate to do it, but this has been David's Book Talk. We've been talking to Henry. Thank you, Henry.
Thank you, David.
And we'll talk to you next time.